This is part two of Job, Faith in Crisis. First, a quick review of the first lesson. The issue in Job is not do the innocent suffer, or even why the innocent suffer, but it's how the innocent should respond when they suffer and they don't deserve it. Job is blameless. He's presented as a perfect man, perfect family, and that's necessary for the theology of the book. He needs to be a man who has done no wrong in order for his suffering to be completely undeserved. We must be careful that we're not trying to force some kind of Protestant interpretation on Job. What I mean is, I read some commentaries and they say, well, Job is self-righteous, or Job doesn't know how sinful he is. Well, maybe he's self-righteous. I can't really tell that from reading Job. Or we'll say, you know, the Apostle Paul in Romans 3 affirms no one is righteous, and, you know, if Job probably has some secret sin. Paul in Romans 3 is generalizing about the human race. There are exceptions. Paul is generalizing about the sorry state of our human race. We don't need to seek suspiciously some extra sin in Job's life. Job responded spiritually. He held on to his faith, although he was in crisis. His claim is right, that he hasn't done anything to deserve this. The tension comes between his theology and reality, because his theology is that the guilty would be suffering, the righteous are rewarded. So that's the problem. It's not that what he observes is wrong, it's his theology. And what he says about God is actually correct. It's commended by the Lord in the end. So first, let's look at the advice of his three friends. You know, his three friends come when they hear of the misfortune, and they set out from their own place. There's Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar. Eliphaz is the oldest. And they met and journeyed together to give him sympathy and comfort. So they have some contact with each other, and they come from different places. They all join. When at a distance they lifted up their eyes and did not recognize him, they began to weep aloud. They tore their cloaks, threw dust in the air over their heads, sat down upon the ground with him 7 days, 7 nights, but none of them spoke a word to Job, for they saw how great was his suffering. I mean, there's some emotion here. At a distance, they can hardly recognize him, you know, as he gets more and more in focus, and they cry and they tear their clothes as though at a funeral, as though Job is dead. But then they sit down for 7 days and nights, and they say nothing. They're just with him. And that's a good thing, what they did there. The problem is once they open their mouths. I'm going to give you a sample of each of the three. Eliphaz, the first to speak, and this is in Job 4:7. Reflect now. What innocent person perishes? Where are the upright destroyed? So Eliphaz reasons that all the suffering that Job is going through is going to end. It'll end soon because Job's a good guy, relatively speaking. You know, it'll be okay. It'll get better. You know, God is right. You know, you've done some wrong, but you're so much better than most people. And so that's a pretty clear statement of the normal view of right and wrong and wisdom. You know, reflect what innocent person perishes. God protects you. You know, of course, Jesus in Luke 13, remember, there was a tower in Siloam, and the tower fell, and it killed a lot of people. Jesus says, no, it's not because, you know, God was getting them. You know, it was because of their sin. That's not the point. You need to be ready for judgment, but that's not what was going on. Even John 9 with the blind man, similar thinking. We tend to think very mechanically about things. But Eliphaz is fairly respectful, and at least in his first speech, he's quite sensitive to Job. The next guy up is Bildad. And we read in chapter 8, 3 and 4, does God pervert judgment? Does the Almighty pervert justice? If your children sinned against him and he has left them in the grip of their guilt, and just stop right there. What Bildad is saying is much harsher. He's saying, the only reason you're alive, Job, is because you've got some righteousness, but your children were not righteous, and that's why they're dead. This is amazing. Of course, he's totally wrong, but very harsh, you know, pitiless. But it gets worse. The third comforter is Zophar. 11:6. And 11:6, Zophar says, God overlooks some of your sinfulness. In other words, Job, you probably deserve a lot worse. You know, God punished you, but he went easy on you. That is, mercy, whatever mercy you would receive from God, that's already included. It's already factored into the equation. One commentary I was reading, this fellow is a Hebrew expert. He translated the book of Job, and he said the word for the comforters, miserable comforters, it's more like torturer comforters. You come to torture me and comfort me. Or you think you're comforting, but you're actually torturing me. Fixed theology. These guys are not so flexible. They're right down the center, orthodox, mainline. Job is confused more than he is flexible. Job is, let me say that better. He's confused. He's more flexible than they are. He doesn't say anything wrong about God. It's the tension, again, is between his theology and what he observes. So he's more willing to be instructed, although he never does quite understand what's going on. So what does this mean? It means that if we open up Job and we remove verses at random, we take out passages, because much of the discussion is from Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, there's a good chance that the verse we're taking, we say, I like this verse, that it's actually wrong. Just as we have in Job, the Satan speaks. So in the Bible, you can't just take out a verse and say, I agree, or that's a good verse. You have to look at the context. In the church, there is no shortage of people like Job's friends, especially the Bildads and the Zophars. People who they say harsh things. They're not flexible in their thinking. Think about the inquisitors in the Inquisition using torture for doctrine. Or think of the Taliban. Or in some countries, they're morals police. The police go around and they measure, is your hair too long? You know, can I see your ankles? You know, morals police. We don't need that in the church. Now, we've talked about his three comforters, who, as we find out at the end of the story, are wrong. What they say is almost totally wrong. But we have not talked about Job's wife or Elihu or Satan. Job's wife lost everything. I mean, she lost their wealth and her 10 children and the respect that her husband enjoyed. And there's a stigma that attaches. She herself would have been suspect. I mean, actually, the best thing that would have happened to her is if Job did die, because then she could remarry and have a life. But she's lost everything. And, you know, at the end of Job, when Job gets another family, 10 children, she's the mother. He doesn't get a new wife. So we could look at Job just from the feminist perspective. Let's look at his wife. And there's so much to learn there. Elihu is a young guy who comes later. He listens to the first three and then he gives his advice. Don't have time to talk about him or even the Satan. No time for demonology right now. The accuser, the Satan, is more of an angel, a son of God. He's not totally evil as depicted in Job. The Hebrews will come to understand more clearly who he is. Now, let's talk about God's response. We have to fast forward to the very end of the book. You know, God is speaking out of the storm, out of the whirlwind. And God, you know, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Like, you don't know what you're saying and you're not on track. It's very humbling to Job. God gives no explanation as to why Job suffered. He never tells him that the Satan and God had a bet. They had a wager. Now, God says, I'm putting my money on Job. And he never learns about that. God neither confirms nor denies the orthodox position that only the innocent suffer. You know, we do reap what we sow. That's a biblical principle, Galatians 6. But to say that you can look at a person's life, and if that person has been blessed, then he's a good guy. And if he's poor, it's his own fault. That's not right. But God neither affirms nor denies this general principle. Job is nowhere near to being a complete explanation of what's going on. God does not condemn Job. The opposite. Actually, he commends him. He commends him. and compares him to his friends and actually tells his friend Eliphaz, you need to ask Job to pray for your friends since you guys have misrepresented me. And just as it seems to be, this is what God is saying. Just as the natural order of things sometimes is amazing, marvelous, we cannot understand it. It's incomprehensible. You know, God talks about all these animals and the stars. Well, so it is with the moral order. The natural order, nature may be hard to understand, but there are mysteries too with the moral order. God rebukes the comforters, and Eliphaz has to ask Job for prayer. And presumably, Job is still on the ash heap, still looking disgusting. Very humbling for Eliphaz. Job is restored. We read this because it's very simple as, well, he was restored instantly. Ba-dum! He gets his camels back. His wife is still there, but he gets new children and his respect, his good name in the community. It's no instant blessing. 10 more children. He gets 7 sons and 3 daughters. That would probably take 10 years or more, don't you think? And the animals too, presumably the huge number of animals doesn't happen instantly. It happens the same way the children. You know, I mean, it's a process. Interestingly, God gives him double the animals. It's kind of as though, you know, in the Torah, if someone is a thief, he has to pay back double. It's almost as though God is saying, you know, I did the wrong thing to you. Here's double. I'm not saying God's doing that, but it's very interesting. But the animals, it would take time for that to happen. Even for Job to regain his honor would take a long time, maybe a whole generation, especially if people are measuring his honor by his wealth. So he has to start over again. What can we say by way of conclusion? Well, first, Job is an amazing model for you and me. It's a model about how to endure severe, inexplicable, seemingly unfair suffering. The book of James refers to Job in James 5, 10 and 11. Take as an example of hardship and patience, brothers, the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Indeed, we call blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, because the Lord is compassionate and merciful. So, the New Testament, and this would be true of many Jewish writers, not just James, the New Testament shows us that Job models perseverance when in suffering. And that's something we can learn from. A second thing, as we conclude, we should read Job with sensitivity. There are differing viewpoints. It's not just one view. And a lot of people are sharing their views and they're not necessarily correct. And we can read Job as a drama, as a poem, as a debate. We can read it as a lawsuit. Third, we should accept, and this should be clear from Job, we should accept the truth that life is not fair. Christianity is a realistic faith, very sometimes brutally realistic. There's no promise we won't suffer. Jesus actually says, follow me and there's a cross. You're going to carry a cross. So I should be asking myself always, does my theology fit reality? Does my theology fit the scriptures? Because Job challenges the status quo. You know, for further study, if you want to go further, I've recorded a number of lessons on the wisdom literature. And I actually have it's not here in my study. My new book, I just got it yesterday. It's called When God is Silent. I'll bring these around the world as I travel in this next year. But the last thing I want to say, especially in our modern world, we must not act as though the universe owes us something or God owes us something. We're entitled. God doesn't owe us anything. God doesn't owe us health. I mean, life is a gift, but God is sovereign. He's in control, and he's good. He's just. He's sovereign. God doesn't owe us health or wealth. He doesn't even owe us explanations when we have questions, when things don't make sense. And holding on when things don't make sense, holding on in crisis, holding on to faith in crisis, that's what Job did, and that's what at some point in all of our lives we too will need to do. God bless you, and thank you for listening to this iFaith sermon.